Hi, this is Eric Siebert from vSphereLand.com, and you're listening to the Virtually Speaking Podcast.
Let's do this.
What is virtualization?
You're going to learn today.
Innovate like a startup. Deliver like an enterprise.
I hope you're coffeeed up and ready because it's going to be a great day.
I know you're going to dig this.
Oh, yeah.
You're listening to the Virtually Speaking Podcast with Pedro Aero and John Nicholson.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Virtually Speaking Podcast, episode number 54. My name is Pete Fletcher, a.k.a. Pedro Aero, and joining me as always is your friend and mine, Mr. John Nicholson. John, how you doing, sir?
Good. Getting ready for VMworld. It's coming.
Oh, yeah. It is going to be here before you know it, my friend. I don't know about you, but I have been heads down on my presentations and preparation for the podcast because we will be in the HCI zone, which is part of the VMware's booth in the Solutions Exchange. So be sure to come by and check us out. But yeah, man, hey, this week, speaking of the podcast, they announced the final results for the top VBlog of 2017. And so joining us for the beginning of this podcast is the man behind all of that awesomeness, Mr. Eric Siebert. Eric, welcome to the podcast.
Hey now, thank you. Glad to be here. And just for the record, I voted for you guys.
Oh, wow. Thank you. We appreciate
that. I feel special.
Absolutely. Yeah, we were very honored to even be counted among anybody in that group. But man, all the work that you put into that thing is pretty amazing. Appreciate you for doing that.
Oh, yeah, no problem. You know, I've been doing this for about 8-9 years now. And, you know, every year I've gotten a little bit better at doing some of the automation around this in Excel to make it a little bit easier on this. You know, some parts are still out of manual hell work, but, you know, I've tried to automate as much as possible in that. So it's gotten to the point where it's not too bad now these days to do it every year.
I just got to ask, has it gotten easier to identify my 100 fraudulent votes that were done over VPN? You know,
I've gotten very good at identifying suspicious votes in that. It's kind of funny because sometimes you'll see the same person as number one, and then you'll see like 9 blogs or 11 blogs in a row that are all alphabetical right behind that and stuff. And, you know, it's pretty easy to find some of those ones that are, you know, kind of suspicious, and I toss a lot of that stuff. So, but for the most part, it's been fairly straight. And I've had a few years where people have gone in there and done some malicious things, but try to keep it all straight and on the up and up.
Well, hey, for those that have not heard, we would love to have you do the announce. I know William Lamb took first place in the top V blog. If you haven't seen the list, go to vSphereLand.com and you'll get the full list of all the top blogs and all the top podcasts and all those other awesome categories. But Eric, tell us, how did we fare in this contest of yours?
So podcast is a category that I've had for many years. And I think you guys were new this year to that category, right?
Yes.
That's correct?
Yep.
Okay. So you actually fared really good in that. You were number 2 behind V Brown Bag. So you guys did great, and actually the first time out. And I think more and more people are, you know, becoming aware of your podcast. And I think from what you told me that your numbers are pretty good too, and that you get a good listenership on your side and that. So it's only up for you from here, man. Why don't you take that number one spot next year?
We're coming for you. We're coming for your V Brown Bag. Just kidding. Nah.
Hey, you know, we may not have Arbitron ratings, but we've got Eric to keep us accountable. So
yeah, you guys do good work though. You know, I think a lot of people enjoy that, and I really enjoyed that Leroy Jenkins type video from somebody sent you a week or two ago on listening to your intro there.
Yeah, that was Russ Cantwell. He's a maniac, man.
Yeah, that was pretty amusing in that. You got a good theme song, though. So, you know, you would get number one vote if there was theme songs for these podcasts. I think you would have number one easily.
Oh, man. Well, let's have that as a category next year.
Yeah. And for Russ, actually, he works with the SevOps. They do the short educational videos. So I think they need a category of their own for the ridiculously cool videos they make. So,
oh, yeah. All right. Well, Eric, thank you so much for joining us. And also, thank you for all you do for this V community, because it's a lot of work. And I think you make the community better as a whole. So keep up the good work, my friend.
Great. Thank you, guys. We'll see you at VMworld.
Later. Good guy. All right. Well, this week, we've got a really good episode for you on vSAN Stretch Cluster. John, while you were on vacation, I had the opportunity to talk to a couple of guys, one of our peers, Jace McCarty in the vSAN TM group, but also the co-author of the Host Resources Deep Dive, Niels. John, did you get a chance to listen to that episode?
Yeah, I did. I'd like to say a couple of things. One, it doesn't surprise me that we have someone in Europe talking about stretch clusters because, what is it, fiber is free and running between everywhere over there?
Pretty much.
Yeah, like, you know, I'm in Texas. All our cities are more than 5 milliseconds apart. But no, from a standpoint of stretch clustering, just my experiences historically with the technology was very powerful, but it was always often outrageously expensive. And it wasn't just about, you know, the fiber and things like that. It was, you know, doing FCOE over layer two extensions. Stuff just got weird. There was a lot of complexity. Sometimes that complexity could bite you and actually cause outages on something that's supposed to be even more highly available.
Oh yeah.
So I like the whole concept of, you know, moving to a pure IP-based transit, you know, vSAN having a really simple and easy to deploy, as well as very low cost. It scales down very well.
Absolutely. All right. Well, without any further ado, we will leave you with our vSAN stretch cluster conversation with Jason Niels. Enjoy. Today, we've got two guests on, one from VMware, Mr. Jace McCarty from the vSAN Technical Marketing Group. Hey, Jace, how you doing, sir?
Oh, doing great. Good to be here.
Awesome. Also joining us is another guest that's been on our show before, one of the authors of the Host Resources Deep Dive, Niels. Niels, welcome back.
Hey, Pete. Thanks for having me.
You notice I didn't try to destroy your name again, your last name, which I still can't pronounce?
It's a difficult one. Ahort. It's all about the G.
All right. Well, listen, the reason I brought you two on is because I know for a fact, whether you admit it or not, that you guys are both big brains when it comes to stretched clustering, whether it's with storage vendors outside of VMware or whether it's with vSAN. And so I thought it would be a good conversation to have with you gentlemen. Jace, you've done a lot of work with vSAN stretch cluster at VMware. So I'd like to start with you, if you don't mind. Tell me a little bit about what's going on with vSAN stretch clusters. What exactly is that? And how does that differ from a traditional vSAN cluster?
Well, Pete, stretch clusters with vSAN is really different than the traditional, I'll say, mechanism, if you will, when it comes to stretch clustering. And really what we basically do is we go and we isolate a vSAN cluster into two fault domains. We have to have three fault domains when it comes to satisfying a policy of protection across the two sites. But really, essentially, we take a vSAN cluster, we split it into two different sites. Then we use a witness, either a host or appliance, at a third site, which basically provides quorum in the event of, let's say, one of those two sites goes offline. The great thing about this is the fact that it's all done through software. There's not anything that we need special. We don't have to have any particular switches. Now, I will say there are some networking requirements. We can go a little bit deeper into that in a bit, but it's pretty simple. You know, let's say you want to take, I don't know, as an example, let's say 16 nodes, and you wanted to put 8 in one data center and 8 in another data center. Provided you've got the right connectivity, make some particular, you know, network configurations, that's really about it. We don't really require any particularly special type of hardware from a normal install.
Well, see, right there, we could park for about a half an hour because that's very different from some of my experiences with traditional stretch clusters solutions. Usually, it has to be a one-for-one. Usually there are very specific hardware requirements, you know, very specific fiber channel switches, et cetera. And then the big part is the amount of hosts, right? Usually it's a one for one. If you've got, whether it's two nodes or whether it's four nodes, but you have to have a very specific amount of nodes that are exactly the same and everything is synchronously replicated. So that's not the case with a vSAN stretch cluster?
Well, so we don't really necessarily have any particular guidance as of yet if we were to have imbalanced clusters, if you will. So let's say we wanted to have 10 in one site, 5 in another site. We don't really necessarily have any guidance around that. Previously, we've always recommended that everything's got to be the same, one for one. So if you've got 5 here, you've got 5 there, that type of thing. Sure. But that's kind of changing a bit, though, with vSAN 6.6 with the addition of local protection and also site affinity. Right? Site affinity now gives us the capability within a stretch cluster config to be able to, or stretch cluster vSAN config, to be able to run a subset, you know, from an affinity perspective where we only want to protect in the preferred site or only want to protect in the secondary site, that type of thing. So I would say that we're probably going to have some recommendations coming out at some point, you know, from an imbalanced cluster type configuration, if you will. But we've got a lot more flexibility now with the release of 6.6 that came out in April, you know, giving us much more granular level control specific to that. So it's a bit different than a traditional where it's, we've got the same here as we've got over there, that type of thing.
Sure.
But yeah, no, it's, you know, it's really good, the flexibility that we have now. And one of the challenges that we had in 6.1, 6.2, and 6.5 was the fact that we only had one copy of data in each site. So if we didn't have copy, let's say we had a drive failure, host went offline, we, you know, put it in maintenance mode, but we didn't choose the right, I'll say, either ensure accessibility or full migration mode, then there's a distinct possibility we'd have to service requests from the opposite site. Whereas now with 6.6 and the ability to run local protection, the fact that we can do either mirrored protection locally with hybrid clusters or We can do mirrored or erasure coded protection with all flash clusters. It makes it a lot more flexible and more resilient at the same time with 6.6.
Yeah, that's something I want to unpack a little bit. But before we do, I want to take one step back. And so the traditional setup with a vSAN stretch cluster is you've got two fault domains, and then you've got a witness. Now, the witness itself, that's not within the vSAN cluster, right? This is a separate, is it a host? Is it an appliance? What is this vSAN witness?
So it's kind of interesting, and I think we're changing the, maybe not the narrative, but the description or the way we were describing it. So if you really look at it, clustering typically is going to require two or more contributors, and in some cases, you will require a witness. Well, in vSAN stretch clusters, we typically have two fault domains, and then we have a witness providing quorum for those two. And there's been some conversations in the past where we've said, you know, we've got three fault domains. Well, if you really technically look at the configuration, you'll see that we've got a preferred fault domain and a secondary fault domain. And then the witness is within the UI. It's selected to participate as a witness, but that witness doesn't necessarily reside within the same cluster. Now, if you look under disk management within the cluster, you actually see that those disks do belong to that cluster. So it's kind of a I'm part of it, but I'm not part of it type thing, right? As far as that goes. Now, when it comes to the makeup of what constitutes being a witness, it could be a physical host that has, you know, let's say a normal boot device, normal ESXi boot device with at least two, I'll say capacity devices, if you will. One only has to be 10 gigs, and we will tag that as an SSD device. So we can use SSD or traditional spinning drives and tag it as if it were an SSD. So we don't really need it. And then a capacity device, and capacity devices can be up to 350 gigs. We can have up to three of those. I mean, they can be larger, but we're only going to consume about 350 per disk, right? Okay. Depending on some factors, which we can get into in a bit when it comes to some sizing conversations. The challenge with that configuration, though, is it requires a physical piece of hardware. You do require an ESXi license.
Cache, exactly.
That'll take away from your licensing, absolutely, you know, that type of thing. The alternative is we have the opportunity of running, some people have called it a nested ESXi host, which is not really an accurate description. It's really just a virtualized ESXi install. That's okay. What it is. And the reason it's not nested is because we don't allow any VMs to be run on it. It's imported into the cluster. It does have a license included as part of that. So that doesn't cost anybody anything. Now, you do have to have, though, a place to run it, right? Where is it going to run? Well, we can run it on another cluster somewhere else. Let's say a third site. Maybe we're doing DR to a third site and we've got some hosts there.
Yeah.
We can run it on top of that. I did a validation with a couple of the other guys in Sabu back in November of last year, where we validated running it on vCloud Air. I'm currently in the process of testing it out on, Revelo, and just a little personal test, that type of thing. And I've personally been running, when I wasn't running it in vCloud Air, I ran it on basically Workstation, which is not a supported configuration today, but I ran it on Workstation for the better part of about, 8 or 9 months, right? Yeah. So from a support standpoint, we supported in vCloud Air. We supported in a vCloud Air network partner. We supported on a standalone free ESXi host if you want. So if you've got a free ESXi license that's not participating in any particular cluster or anything, you can run the witness on top of that and it is supported. So a couple of different ways that we can, you know, go about achieving the, I'll say, servicing the witness, if you will, requirement. We do have a requirement, though, of one witness per cluster today. We've had a lot of people ask for, let's say I've got a couple stretch clusters. Let's say I'm doing two node, which is essentially a 1+1+1 stretch cluster config. Let's say I've got, you know, 500 remote sites, and I want to consolidate those witness roles, if you will, to one or just a few witness appliances. We're not there yet, but we're definitely looking at being able to combine that into a single witness.
Okay, so it's a one per cluster. So if you've got multiple vSAN clusters, you're going to have multiple witnesses.
Correct. Today.
Yeah.
The witness thing actually is one of the most important things to design the vSAN stretch clusters, right? We just recently implemented one and really had to think through where to place it. As you just mentioned, Jace, vCloud Air is an option, even Revelo for that matter. But it's still bound to the 10 milliseconds round trip latency, right?
Well, now for the witness, it really depends on the cluster size. So if it's a two node, what we quite often use for robo. We typically say for the witness, communication between each of the sites and the witness is 500 milliseconds for the two-node configs. For up to 10-node configs, it's a 200 millisecond round-trip time. And then for 11 to 15 hosts, which is currently the maximum we can have per site in a stretch cluster config, it's actually 100 milliseconds. So as far as the witness, it's really dependent on the number of components, how many hosts are participating, that type of thing.
Ah, I see. So it's not just one number for every single deployment.
No, not at all.
Okay.
Not at all.
And I can find the details on which one for my deployment on storagehub.vmware.com or?
Absolutely. The stretch cluster and two node guide is one of the best places to find that info.
Very cool. So Niels, before we even start diving more specifically into how you configure these policies and all the different, the architecture of vSAN Stretch Cluster, I'm curious, you recently deployed one in the Netherlands. What was the reasoning? Why did you choose vSAN Stretch Cluster? Was there anything specific to that customer that this Stretch Cluster solution met the needs?
Yeah. When looking at stretch clusters, you always look at availability and it's all about business continuity, right? So for this specific customer, it's actually a factory, a very large factory, which has multiple data centers. Now, we wanted to be able to fill over the application from one data center to the other in a fully automatic way, and that combined with a specific SLA. So looking at those requirements, Stretch Cluster was probably the one and only solution that was fit for this requirement. And that's an interesting thing because it comes with a lot of, well, not per se drawbacks, right? You have a fully automated cluster, which is awesome, but it comes with at the cost. So the cost of economics, the licensing, the hardware that needs to be available to take over when a data center fails. In the end, we needed to comply to a SLA, which we were not able to comply to the SLA with a manual DR solution. So there you go. That was our primary reason to go for a vSAN Stretch Cluster.
Yeah.
I completely agree. You know, I seem to have this conversation with partners and customers as well as our field pretty regularly. You know, it's that question of to stretch or not to stretch. You know, is, let's say, vSphere replication and SRM a better fit, or are stretch clusters a better fit? And, you know, what are my constraints? What are my, what type of use cases do I have? I think that with 6.6, we've added quite a few more bells and whistles, you know, the feature set to really make it a bit more robust, and that, you know, stretch clusters are definitely about availability. I cannot argue there whatsoever. That's the primary reason why we've gone that route. And in the past, it was, I would say, a bit of a challenge for us with the way that we, you know, accomplished data placement when it comes to vSAN, yeah. Right? And what I mean by that is, let's say, for instance, we're using, let's say we're doing Exchange or SQL or whatever else, and we had a copy in both the primary site and the secondary site, then we probably wouldn't at that point choose application level of redundancy, right? Whereas now, let's say we can carve it up a little bit differently, where we don't necessarily write everything to both sites, but then, you know, we've got a combination of some redundancy for applications that don't have, you know, that redundancy across sites, and then the ability to carve out the ones that do, right? So, like, you know, always on availability groups or Exchange, you know, DAGs, right? Database availability groups. The fact that we can actually let the application do what it needs to do at an application layer.
Yep.
But then the other supporting pieces that don't support that, then we can still go active as far as that goes. So a lot more flexibility. I'll agree also with Niels that when it comes to putting this stuff in place, sizing is paramount. You know, we want to make sure that we haven't oversubscribed storage. We want to make sure that we haven't oversubscribed compute. You know, if we do fail everything over, we need to be able to accommodate every bit of that as far as that goes. And then, you know, there's also the conversation of what happens when I grow? Do I have a large enough pipe? You know, let's say I start off with 5 hosts per site. I grow to 10 hosts per site and my workload doubles. Do I still have enough bandwidth to, you know, to accommodate for that? Those types of things, all very relevant, very important, not just to the initial design, but as that particular installation grows.
Yeah. Is there a difference between how vSAN handles data placement? Because now you've got two sides, you're replicating. Is the data placement determined by the storage policies that you configure, or is this something that's underlying for the entire cluster?
It's really dependent on the policy. When it comes to vSAN, it's essentially a single policy. We choose erasure coding in the preferred site. We're going to get erasure coding in the secondary site, and everything's going to match up as far as that goes. We don't really have the capability of being able to say, well, we want erasure coding here, but we want mirroring here and that type of thing. We haven't really exposed more granular policies, you know, as far as that goes yet. So, you know, it's important when it comes to sizing, important when it comes to capacity, as well as important to the decisions that you make when you're going to perform maintenance, you know, those types of things, right? How many hosts can I take offline in this site versus the other and that type of thing, you know? So definitely a lot of things to consider. Previous to the introduction of local protection, if you compared to a traditional clusters were already doing, let's say I've got NetApp filers on each side, I'm doing RAID 6 underneath on, or RAID DP, excuse me, you know, on on both sides, right? Well, previous, we just had one copy in preferred and one copy in secondary, and that was it. And if host went offline, or, you know, we had an isolated host or whatnot, we had to fetch from the other side. But now with local protection, we don't have to do that. At the same time, we're only doing mirrored writes across sites. Even if we have erasure coding for local protection, we're only doing mirrored writes across sites. And, you know, that doesn't really kind of change the dynamics of our sizing. You know, so if you're running a 6.1, a 6.2, a 6.5 stretch cluster, and you decide to go to 6.6 and you decide to employ erasure coding, your sizing is not going to change because we're still only doing mirrored writes like we did before.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the part that was interesting to me when I first started looking at this. Even in when I was designing policies and I was playing with it in my lab, I noticed that, oh, there's two types of policies that I need to configure. The local protection, right? And decide what type of RAID I wanted on that, what type of fault tolerance. But that was only for the local, right? And then it would actually sync that data. But you can't choose different ways to synchronize the data, right? That's just always a mirror across. But then you have local protection that you configure granularly with your policies, correct?
Well, it's only a mirror if you choose a primary level of failures to tolerate of 1.
Okay.
So if you choose 0, then at that point, you've got to pick a site. You've got to pick affinity, either preferred or secondary, so it knows where to put it. Now, going a bit further, and we're not really tying into DRS yet, but it's also important to look at DRS rules and ensure that, okay, let's say I've got data pinned from a policy perspective to the preferred site. I want to make sure that VM never comes up in the secondary side.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Yep.
So I've got to do a little bit more homework. I actually put together a PowerCLI script not too long ago on code.vmware.com. You can do a search on DRS and you'll find it. And it basically just go through, you tag VMs of which site you want them to be in, and it ensures that your host affinity groups as well as your vSAN affinity policies match up. It actually creates them on the fly. So pretty cool.
So, Jace, I noticed on the most recent version, especially when I took the vSAN 6.5 class, which, by the way, was awesome. If you haven't attended that class, I definitely recommend it. Learned a whole bunch about vSAN 6.5 in there. But one of the things I noticed was that they changed the name of the failures to tolerate to PFTT. Is there a difference, and why is that?
So we went from initially just number of failures to tolerate to a combination of primary level of failures to tolerate, that's essentially across sites, and then secondary level of failures to tolerate, that's within a site. Now, if you really think about the construct, if you were to transpose a stretch cluster config onto a normal config, it would essentially be the same thing as fault domains, right? So, and we're not doing this today in vSAN 6.6. Who knows? It may show up at some point, but, and I think it'd be pretty interesting if we did that. But, you know, really what it is when vSAN writes any kind of data, let's say we've got a 4-node cluster without any fault domain set up, or 8-node cluster without any whatnot, we're really going to ensure that we're meeting policy compliance requirements by distributing data across multiple hosts. When we add fault domains, let's say I've got an 8-node config and I break it up into 4 fault domains where each fault domain has 2 nodes. When I go and I write that data, I'm writing to 1 fault domain, a secondary fault domain, and then a third, let's say if I'm doing mirroring with my, I'll call it witness component as opposed to, or yeah, witness component as opposed to, you know, a witness appliance, right? But
okay.
Where I'm getting at with this is that primary level of failures to tolerate is really more of a fault domain type construct, if you will, right? Now, stretch clustering with 6.6, we actually get a little bit more granular where we do it within a single site. And kind of where I was going with this is wouldn't it be really interesting if we were to bring this to regular vSAN in such a way where we could have, let's say, a 64-node cluster, and we could break that up into 8 fault domains and then still protect individually within those fault domains, right?
Yeah.
I think that would be pretty cool. Obviously, we don't have anything like that today, but one of the challenges, and I've got a really good table on Storage Hub within the stretch cluster and 2-node guide that kind of covers this. It's also something else to consider when you go and employ these policies. And what I mean by that is just an example. With stretch clustering FTT1 version 6.1 through 6.5, a 100 gig VM, let's say it's using all of its space, is going to take 100 gig on the preferred site, 100 gig on the secondary site. Now, once we add, you know, let's say we go to 6.6, that FTT becomes PFTT, and now I'm protecting across sites, I'm still only going to take up 100 gigs and 100 gigs. Now, if I add that rule for the secondary failure level of failures to tolerate, and I choose mirroring as an example, I'm now going to double that capacity in each site. So as you employ these additional policies, it's also important to consider what the storage consumption is and how it's going to change. You know, and it may be fine that, you know, it may be fine that mirroring is because you've got a workload that really requires performance and mirroring is best. Obviously take that into account, but at the same time, you know, maybe erasure coding is better, you know, and you can, you know, get a little bit of space savings as far as that goes, right? So something that you really have to keep in consideration when it comes to consuming additional capacity resources once you employ local protection.
Well, I think that's the cool part about being able to set multiple policies, right? Because you're going to have some workloads that can benefit from erasure coding, right? Whereas you may have some other workloads that don't necessarily need that, that depend on availability more. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if, you know, one of the biggest challenges that I see when I talk to admins that go and they say, well, you know, I've got a 2-node config. Let's say we've got 8 terabytes per node. You know, again, stretch cluster, I'm just kind of boiling it down to a simple, you know, example.
Yep.
Quite often admins, engineers, whatnot, they'll look at that and they'll say, okay, I've got 8 and 8. That gives me 16 terabytes of consumable space. Well, it's not really, because that's before any protection is applied. And if you look at, let's say, a traditional stretch cluster, let's say we've got NetApp and NetApp or EMC and EMC or whoever else and whoever else, we're really only going to see what's available after the protection, right? So, you know, it's important to look at capacity for what it is and how that relates to specifically to policies that are being used.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Okay. So I know earlier we mentioned that there really isn't a limitation in terms of physical distance, right? Like, like I know in my days of looking at like Metro Cluster, one of the big different, they were really popular overseas because there were a lot of towns within Europe that were very close to each other, right? So they could handle some of the shorter distances between those towns to have that, you know, fiber connection and to be able to meet those aggressive requirements in terms of round trip latencies. So you said that there were some specific networking configurations for vSAN. And I think you mentioned that there was a latency of 10 milliseconds. Is that true, round trip?
So when it comes to inter-site, when I say inter-site between, let's say, the preferred and the secondary sites, with vSAN, we have a 5 millisecond round trip time latency requirement. And so essentially 2.5 each way,
okay,
as far as that goes. There's not really any distance per se. I know then that at one point when I worked at EMC, we had some thresholds of, from a distance perspective, I think it was like 180 kilometers or something like that when it came to using VPlex. And that may have changed since I was there, as far as that goes. But we don't really tie anything specific to a distance. You know, we really only tie it to a network performance of, you know, the 5 milliseconds round trip time. Now, we typically recommend 10 gigabit connectivity at a minimum, and it really depends on the amount of writes that are occurring. How many IOPS, how large the writes are they 4K, the 8K, so on and so forth, those types of things. And those are variable. I've seen some cases where, you know, only maybe, you know, 2 gig is required just because of the specific workload. We do recommend 10 gig as a minimum, but it sometimes could be less and sometimes could be significantly more. It really depends.
That's actually an interesting thing. I was just talking about my colleagues about the network implications when using a distributed file system like vSAN, right? You just mentioned it. It strongly depends, obviously, on the workloads and the configured storage policies. But any thoughts about sizing with regards to replication, vSAN replication between hosts in the local side, but even with the mirrored side?
That's a pretty good question. I think I want to, if I recall correctly, we had an internal discussion about this, I'll say early on, just before local protection came into play, right? Before it was released in 6.6. And as far as the normal networking requirements go, there's not really anything different than running a traditional vSAN, you know, configuration as far as that goes. So as far as local bandwidth requirements, it's essentially the same as it would be if you were running a local cluster as opposed to a stretch cluster. It isn't until you move it over to be a stretch cluster config that you really have to consider the bandwidth as far as that goes. Now, you know, it's important also to, and we don't really go deep into this specifically within the gears of StorageHub and some of our other online documentation, but if you think about the way that the distributed object manager within vSAN is handling all these writes to all the different locations, as I mentioned before, writes are always mirrored across sites. So how do we handle, let's say, if we've got erasure coding, but we've also got mirroring across happening at the same time? Well, what we're essentially doing is we're using a DOM proxy on the alternate sites. Whichever site owns the object, if you will, let's say a VMDK is owned by the preferred site or it's owned by the secondary site, we're basically using a DOM proxy. And what that proxy then does is acts in conjunction with the normal distributed object manager to ensure that once it gets the full write, it then, depending on what the local storage policy is, whether it be erasure coding or mirroring, it then locally writes in the same fashion. So it's not like if we choose as a secondary policy, we choose erasure coding, we're never going to see any erasure coding type read plus modify operations go across the wire. You know, and that's one of the great things about that is people don't really have to resize anything when it comes to their inter-site communication as far as that goes, you know, because it's just mirrored. It's the same as it would be if we were just using a PFTT of one and a SFTT of zero.
Yeah.
Right? So it's essentially the same at that point. So within a single, either preferred or secondary, it's really essentially the same as far as, you know, connectivity as it would be for a normal vSAN cluster.
And you support layer 2 and layer 3 for inter-site communication?
For everybody but you, Pete.
I appreciate that.
So that's another good point, right? And I talked to a customer on Friday actually about this, and they were in the process of going through a quick deployment, and everything that they had set up was layer 3, and they hadn't moved everything over to 6.6 yet, and they were saying, you know, it was a bear getting multicast set up, and we're really looking forward to unicast, and multicast itself is not inherently tremendously difficult. You don't have to be a CCIE, you know, to configure it. But depending on the vendor and depending on the implementation mechanism that they have, there may be some nuances, some gotchas, whatever that you've got to accomplish. And for that, we've traditionally said we primarily recommend layer 2, but we do support layer 3. Sometimes it takes a little bit more work, you know, to get layer 3 up and going as far as that goes. With unicast, obviously, it's a good bit more simplistic. So from a recommendation perspective, I think layer 2 or layer 3 is perfectly fine, you know, as a recommendation for 6.6, once you move over to that unicast as far as the transport mechanism.
Niels, what did you guys use for your deployment?
So we used, obviously, 6.6.
Nice.
For reasons we already discussed. And that's the beauty about software, right? So same hardware, different software version, and you all of a sudden get these nifty new features,
yep.
Especially around stretch clusters. So one of the things that you just mentioned, multicast, and my current customer doesn't felt comfortable with multicast whatsoever. They had some network outages, and they just wanted to keep things as simple as possible. So 6.6 with unicast, in this specific case, a layer 2 network, that was the perfect fit for them.
Yeah, unicast is the only option, right, for 6.6, which, I don't know, I've never been a big fan of multicast anyway, so it seems to me like that should be a very good thing, as your customer attests to, right?
Yeah, just keep it simple.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the KISS method, right? keep it simple, stupid. Yeah, no.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah, unicast is just so much easier. We were really, really glad to be able to bring that to 6.6 to all builds, if you will. I mean, there are some considerations and challenges specific to that. All the hosts, as well as the witness that are participating in the cluster, have to be upgraded to 6.6, you know, for it to be unicast. Now, if I have a 6.5 or 6.2, 6.1, and I move to 6.6, had a customer a couple weeks ago run across this, they could not figure out why they weren't moving over to unicast, and they hadn't updated their witness. Now, as I mentioned before, the witness is not part of the cluster, but the disks are part of the cluster.
Right.
And all communication with the witness has already been unicast, but because of all the disks in the, you know, within the disk management UI, if you will, because they all weren't at the same level, and because all the clusters or all the ESX builds in play for the hosts and the witness, because they weren't all at 6.6 code, unicast was not turned on by the cluster. It also is something to consider as we, you know, let's say add new hosts, let's say as we grow a cluster, you know, let's say we decide we, you know, so we've got a, as an example, we're leasing our hosts and we decide to bring, you know, some older hosts offline and replace them with newer hosts. those newer hosts still have to be at a 6.6 or better. So if we're already running at 6.6, we add some hosts that are 6.5, they're going to be partitioned and they're not going to play well with others until they've been upgraded to 6.6 and they can truly participate as a contributing member of the cluster. Sounded kind of positive from for Monday, huh?
Yeah, but it is interesting to see the adoption grade of 6.6, right? Because in my experience, customers are always kind of holding back new releases when it comes to ESXi. And I always recommend them when they are using or thinking about vSAN to go for the latest version. How do you see? How do you guys see that? If a customer is running, for instance, I don't know, vSAN 5.5 is the first version. Is that still around even? And are those customers upgrading to 6.6?
So I'll say, and Pete, I'm sure you'll agree with me that we still have some customers on 5.5.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it's one of those questions of, level of comfort, compatibility. You know, additionally, you've got, you know, questions concerning, whether it be local policies of certification and accreditation, that type of thing. I was in the military for about 24 years. I was in the Air Force. Pete was in the Air Force as well. And,
yep.
Something may be better if you upgrade or start fresh with the latest, that type of thing. But quite often, until some piece of paper or what I would call an OI, an operating instruction, until you've got, approval to start with something new from a validation and certification process, sometimes you're not allowed to.
Yeah.
I know in my time in the financial sector and health insurance, it was kind of the same way. We had to kind of get I would call it a DAA, that's kind of a military term, designated approval authority. We basically had to have somebody of responsibility say that they were comfortable with us going with something new. So I think some of it is technical challenges. You know, I mean, I remember days of having some old IBM 440s, X440s that were not being certified for VI3. But the 445s, which are just a few months newer, were certified. So there's a combination of, is the hardware, on the HCL or VCG, is our VMware support up to date? And then sometimes there's some politics involved. It really just kind of depends.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, sure thing. But still, when moving towards a fully software-defined data center, right? And I know you guys would probably agree with me, but I think customers need to work on a mode that its business is able to consume newer versions when it comes to vSAN or NSX even, to actually make use of the new fantastic features, right?
Oh, absolutely.
And because it's one thing you say that you are going for a software-defined thing, storage or network, but it's another thing to actually adopt and quickly adopt and make use of all the new things.
Can't disagree.
Well, there's a reason they call it leading bleeding, right? Because there is a little bit of bleeding that comes along with sometimes testing any new technology, which is why I understand there is some hesitation. But I will say this is, and this just recently came out, with 6.6.1, vSphere Update Manager is now integrated with vSAN. And so really cool how it automatically goes in. All you do is you put in your My VMware credentials inside of your vSAN cluster. It goes out there automatically and builds a vSAN recommendation baseline for you that is specific to your hardware. So you can actually get all your patches and all of the possible upgrades that you can get for your cluster automatically built into a baseline that you can deploy to your cluster and have sort of a complete non-disruptive near one touch type deployment. So it's definitely something that VMware considers, right? VUM has been around for a while, great tool. Mm-hmm. I do believe in updating. And I think with this new VUM integration with vSAN, I think it just got a whole lot simpler.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah, sometimes you got to sell it to the graybeards, Pete,
Yep.
you got some of those folks. It's like, what is all this virtualization mumbo jumbo? It's witchcraft and that type of thing. But, I'm being serious, whether it be the great things we're doing with NSX, the great things we're doing, now with vSAN, some of the just amazing automation that we've got VRA, a lot of people, I would say in traditional, environments are a bit overwhelmed in some cases. And in other cases, I think they may fear for their jobs because, we're doing a lot of things that, we're kind of replacing, some of those responsibilities, you know, which to me is great, you know, especially, I mean, not replacing the responsibilities, but the fact that we can go and we can tie everything to a policy.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and I mean, it's just, it's for me to be able to easily not only apply a policy, but at the same time, be able to report on that policy and those types of things are really amazing. And, you know, I think once traditional environments realize that power and, you know, can have a much more efficient, you know, environment, I think they, you know, I think most people embrace it. Stretch clustering, adding, you know, active capability with even more, you know, possibilities with local protection now and site affinity and all that other kind of stuff. It's just it's a win. I mean, it's just it put simply.
Nice. Well, Jace, I'm going to be leaving tons of links on the show notes page for this podcast, which will give us detailed information on sizing guidance, network configuration, minimums and maximums and all that stuff. But why don't you wrap it up for us? You know, like we've talked a little bit about use cases. We've talked about why you might want to do this and some of the differences between vSAN stretch cluster and, say, traditional stretch cluster. But what are we missing? Is there anything else that we need to really consider before we take off?
The biggest thing to me, the biggest piece of value when it comes to stretch clustering, whether it be traditional or vSAN, if you look at everything when it comes to providing, I'll just say workload availability. What I mean by workload availability, you know, the capability of performing work. The hardest part of that is the data. It's not hard to have mirrored compute. It's not hard to have mirrored network. All those pieces are. I mean, I don't want to devalue, you know, any of the other platforms or pieces out there, but sure. Storage is the piece that's unique to whatever the application is or whatever the, you know, whatever the workload is, you know, whatever people are trying to accomplish, right? That's the unique piece of all this. And that's the hardest part, to make sure it's in multiple places simultaneously and make sure that it's up to date and relevant.
Oh, yeah.
That's the hardest part. The fact that with stretch clustering, again, traditional or with vSAN, gives us the capability of providing that in both places, you know, in a robust fashion, very, very fast, you know, synchronously, that type of thing is paramount. If you compare that to some of the other active passive type, you know, ways of doing the same thing, obviously at a different cost, you know, what level of availability are we really trying to sustain and achieve? Now, sometimes, you know, for the applications that don't necessarily have their own built-in redundancy, stretch clusters are really the only way to provide that. In other cases where applications have their own level of redundancy, that may or may not necessarily be required or necessary as far as that goes. Going further, though, where I think we really excel, we do, you know, very well, is the fact that we don't require any particular type of hardware. You know, we only require the connectivity.
Yeah.
And any customer today that has a normal vSAN, you know, configuration, provided they move up to an enterprise, you know, license for vSAN, and they decide they want to take half their hosts and move them to another site, or they want to add the same number of hosts and move those to another site, as long as they've got the appropriate connectivity, they have the capability of performing putting in a stretch cluster. It's very, very easy. Right, there's not any special knowledge as far as I got to know how to maintain this particular piece of hardware that's accommodating the connectivity between the two sites. You know, I don't have to use any type of, and I'm not naming any names. We've mentioned them here on the podcast a little bit earlier. But point being is I don't have to have special types of hardware to be able to accomplish this. Right, it's very, very easy.
Yep.
And I would definitely be interested in what Niels has to say. You know, specific to the value, you know, stretch clustering, especially with vSAN.
So I totally agree with you, Jace. And in my opinion, policy-based storage is the only way forward. Another great thing about the vSAN environment we just rolled out, it's not per se technical. It's more about economics. We actually calculated a traditional storage platform and compared it to a vSAN cluster. And it was a greenfield scenario. So the costs involved and the investment required for our stretch cluster was actually way lower with vSAN. So that helped a lot next to all the advantages of a distributed system.
Sure.
In terms of performance and scalability and performance while scaling.
Yeah.
Well, I think to build on that as well, maintaining the long-term, you know, viability of the solution, vSAN is a bit more attractive, right? And what I mean by that is with traditional stretch cluster configurations, you know, we typically have to, you know, ensure that, you know, let's say we're using, just as an example, vPlex, you know, if we're let's say, scaling out storage on a on either site, we would have to make sure that anything that we add to that is compatible with vPlex, that type of thing, you know, and as different revisions of different solutions, whether it be, you know, Dell EMC or NetApp or whoever else, right? IBM, you know, whatnot, as all these, you know, come into play, as we grow over time, we've still got to maintain compatibility across everything. Whereas vSAN, it's very easy where we can simply add new hosts, balance our data out, and decommission the old host. So it's not really that difficult to maintain over a much longer amount of time with minimal disruption to the environment in comparison to a traditional configuration. And still, like you mentioned, at a much lower cost.
Awesome. Jace, Niels, thank you so much for joining us today to discuss vSAN Stretch Cluster. I know you're both going to be at VMworld and hopefully talking about some Stretch Cluster. Jace, do you have any Stretch Cluster sessions at VMworld?
So I do have, if I recall correctly, I've got a session, I forget the number right off the top of my head, but it's Successful vSAN Stretch Clusters at VMworld US. And then I also have a session on Successful Robo Design, which will also be covering Stretch Clusters a bit. And I think that's at both the US and VMworld Europe.
Very nice. And Niels, I know you're going to be at VMworld because you're going to be doing a repeat of your host resources deep dive session, correct?
Exactly. So Frank and I are doing our session in both Las Vegas and Barcelona.
Can't wait to attend.
Yeah, I'll be there front row.
Cool. Thanks. As we talked about in the previous episode of the V Speaking podcast, it's amazing to see the enthusiasm of the community, right? So looking forward to having a packed room again.
Oh, yeah. And I want my book signed, too, so I'll be bringing that with me.
Yeah, you should. We'll be happy to sign it, Pete.
Nice. All right. Well, that music tells me it's time to go. And so if you want to get in touch with us, send us an email at podcast@vmware.com. Subscribe to us on SoundCloud or iTunes by searching Virtually Speaking Podcast. You can catch this and all episodes at vspeakingpodcast.com. Next week, we've got an automation story for you that's going to leave you profoundly dumbfounded. But until then, bye for now.
Enough of this jibber jabber.